You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about research into a Wisconsin lake and how we can reconstruct the ecological history hidden beneath the muck. First, it's a new season of Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television.
Sesame Hot.
Without dance, I couldn't say that I would be the person I am today.
My name is Shruti Parthasarathy, and I am a Bharatanatyam or classical Indian dancer from Middleton, Wisconsin. Bharatanatyam is an ancient Indian classical dance form that originated from southern India thousands of years ago, and it essentially tells mythological tales of gods and goddesses. So it's kind of like a play, but with the musicality of dance into it.
That's just one of the stories in the new season of Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television. The seventh season kicks off tomorrow evening. You can see it every Thursday at 7 p.m. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson recently caught up with Wisconsin Life host Angela Fitzgerald and series producer Kelly Saran.
Kelly, tell us about the format of Wisconsin Life.
So Wisconsin Life on the TV side, because we are a partnership with radio, on the TV side, we basically produce stories year-round, kind of traveling around the state with our producers, capturing people's stories, capturing people's amazing talents, passions, even historical links. And we take those stories, we come back to the studio, we have Angela go out on location, experience some things on location, and then we come back and we put together a whole show that's kind of explores location, but then also gets to deep dive into people, these amazing stories we captured all year round.
And how do you find those stories?
We find those stories a number of ways. We have audience suggestions that come in, and I welcome anybody who knows anybody with an exciting story to always contact us. But otherwise, our producers do a lot of deep diving in the communities. Maybe it's local newspapers. Sometimes they're out and about in the community. Sometimes it's just kind of serendipitous, and we come across in a story and we're like, wow, this hasn't been covered in the past, but it's happening in an amazing place up north. So really, it's kind of a collection of all, and we kind of work as a team to kind of bring these stories to the forefront.
And Angela, how do you see your role as host? What do you hope to bring to these stories?
Well, I see myself as a guide in storytelling. So as Kelly mentioned, the producers help to curate the stories, and I'm just leading the audience down the pathway of learning about the awesome people and places that make up our great state.
Well, let's talk about some of the stories we'll be seeing this season. Kelly, I want to start with Eric and Emily Kranz of West Bend. Let's take a listen.
I think part of what draws people to LEGO is this childlike sense of wonder about them. They're colorful. They'll make a beeline for something that is bright, almost as if it's flashing at them. My name is Emily Kranz, and I'm an unofficial LEGO master builder.
So an unofficial LEGO master builder. That's just great. Kelly, tell us more about them.
Yeah, so then right after that, we kind of learned that actually Emily and Eric had met online, and their online story is just very funny of how they met. And then they met online, and Eric actually turned out he loved LEGOs. And so Emily started to get into the LEGO world, and together they started to build this. And their whole basement, their whole house is kind of filled with all these LEGO like worlds. There's a huge Harry Potter world with moving Legos. It's quite amazing. And they actually go around the state, even around the nation, traveling, showing their exhibits with it. But it's kind of a love story that was brought to you by Lego, unofficially.
That's amazing. And I love that it's such a throwback toy. It's not a super high-tech something. It's Legos.
It is. Yeah. And what's funny about it, too, is you kind of have the adults who are really into it because they grew up with it. But then you have these kids that are coming with the generation. So it's something kind of families can all share. And it's funny that this family kind of was found their romance around building.
That's
sweet.
That's really sweet. And Angela, you get to go out and do a lot of fun things and meet a lot of amazing people. You got to do some water skiing. How did that come about?
Well, by doing water skiing, I need to clarify that I tried to water ski.
It is hard.
It is. I realize you have to have really strong core muscles, yes, and I think just confidence that you're not going to fall. But I definitely enjoyed my time with the Plum Skeeters water ski show team. So in addition to them doing a great show where they're doing all sorts of tricks and stunts, they take the time to teach people who are interested like myself. So they were very patient, and we tried a couple different scenarios to get me upright. Didn't really work, but I enjoyed the water. It was such a wonderful temperature. Like, I could have stayed in that lake all day. So it was great.
And they do things on water skis that most of us, I will venture to say, couldn't do on dry land.
Exactly. So I can do or handle snow skiing. I'm like, okay, are these transferable skills? And I quickly learned that no, other than getting the skis on your feet, that's the only thing that transfers between water and snow.
And Kelly, there's a really great story of a pretty amazing young athlete who's sharing her love for water skiing with others.
That's true. And so we ran into the story of Grace, and she started the nonprofit organization Graceful Wakes. And that really came from her mother had gotten in a car crash when she was a teenager, and she lost the ability to use her legs. And so they actually went down, and we can actually share the clip of kind of how Graceful Wake started.
Let's listen to that.
Grace and I and our family had the opportunity to participate in an adaptive clinic in Florida. It was a feeling of freedom and something so different than what I had ever experienced before, to be out of your wheelchair and gliding across the water. It was just an amazing feeling.
So that was like one of the highlights of my life, being able to share something that I love so much and be able to participate in it with my mom. After that experience, I realized that I wanted to provide that same opportunity and ability to water ski to other individuals with physical and cognitive disabilities. And so therefore, with the help of my parents, we founded the nonprofit organization Graceful Wakes.
Yeah, so it's a really sweet story, and you kind of see, my favorite part of that story is just kind of seeing the joy from people who normally they didn't think water skiing was for them, and getting them out on the water, and just that moment of joy we got to capture, and kind of Grace as a young adult doing things that as an adult I'm like, wow, this is in Wisconsin and this is happening right next door. I really wanted to share that story, and our producers did. So it's really sweet that Grace kind of found this way to connect with her mother, but then connect and share that joy with the outside world.
We're talking with Angela Fitzgerald and Kelly Saran right now. Angela is the host of Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television. The new season starts on Thursday, October 3rd at 7 o'clock. And Kelly Saran is the series producer for Wisconsin Life. And they are sharing some of the highlights, some of the many highlights of the upcoming season. And Angela, I have to say, you get to do so many fun things. I'm totally jealous. One was playing vintage baseball.
Yes.
Where and what was that?
So we played vintage baseball with the Menominee Blue Caps. And so what I learned a little bit during that time period was like kind of the history behind the attire and different traditions that they have. Like they don't wear any mitts or anything on their hands. So their ball, well, the ball we used at least was softer. I don't know if historically that was always the case. And they used different terms to represent what was happening in baseball. And so it was fun. I got to join the team. They are very supportive and encouraging, even though I'm not really a baseball player, but I hit something and got to run.
What I was going to say is I learned Angela can hit a ball, and she knocked it out of the park. I was thrilled as a producer.
Well, you know, I'm thinking we might need to get a Wisconsin Public Media softball team together.
Vintage softball. Of course.
What do you know? What has changed over the years in baseball?
Definitely the uniforms. So they were much more conservative back in the earlier time periods than today. That's a big thing. And using things like mitts are also very, very different, as well as the terms that I mentioned. And the umpire wasn't the umpire. He looked more like the Monopoly man. So all those sorts of things have transitioned over time.
That's awesome. I can't wait to see that segment. Kelly, what goes into producing a segment of Wisconsin Life?
Yeah, so there's a lot that goes into it, and it's kind of long lead work. So our producers kind of get their hands in the community. They really learn what stories kind of make it very compelling. So they kind of meet people. They learn about kind of what makes people tick, why they're doing the things they're doing, and then they try to come with a camera crew and try to get that translated on camera. And we try to be just kind of a fly on the wall, but we take that footage, we bring it back in-house, and then it takes about a week to edit each story and kind of fine-tune it. Everybody kind of comes together, and then once that story is done, we take it in the full show, and that takes several months to actually package our entire season together. So we'll be working hard until the end of the season in-house to bring you all of the 13 episodes that you know, but you can always visit wisconsinlife.org to kind of see the news story on TV, but also the news stories that radio puts out as well. So,
and Angela, I think your really deep love and affection for our state comes through every time that you're on the show. What have you learned about our state or about the people that make it so special in this season?
Well, this season, definitely, I got to experience a lot of different things that I have not before. So I can continue to be impressed by just the range of things to do, people to see, places to go that even folks who've lived here their entire lives had no idea that were present. So I consider it a privilege that as someone who's not originally from Wisconsin, that I get to show off Wisconsin even to homegrown folks. So I love that.
And Kelly, I love that the people that are featured in Wisconsin Life come from such different areas of the state, but also different age groups and with different cultural backgrounds. What gives you a lot of satisfaction in producing Wisconsin Life?
I think when I hear kind of the feedback after we get this, after we air the stories, and people get to see their stories and they're really surprised by themselves and kind of how their story really comes together, and they're so proud of it and they get to share it with their community. And I think that's where we hold the most pride, is that we get to really share what's going on that's so special and very unique to our state. But yeah, I think just the pride in knowing that we have the honor of telling people's story, I think what's rings home to me.
Well, Kelly, Angela, thanks so much for coming in, and can't wait for the new season.
Thanks, Judith.
Thank you.
Angela Fitzgerald is the host of Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television. Kelly Saran is the series producer. They talked to Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson. The seventh season of Wisconsin Life kicks off tomorrow evening and airs every Thursday at 7 p.m. on Wisconsin Public Television. You can also find past TV and radio Wisconsin Life episodes at wisconsinlife.org. Lake Mendota in Madison has been called one of the most studied lakes in the world, and it turns out you can learn a lot from the dark brown muck at the bottom of it. UW-Madison researchers recently looked at some of the newest lake sediment samples and what they can tell us about water quality and how to manage it. Jake Walsh is a postdoctoral research fellow with the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center at the University of Minnesota. He led the project as a postdoctoral researcher with UW-Madison's Center for Limnology. He recently wrote about it for WisContext in a piece titled "A Twist in the Tale Told by Muck at the Bottom of Lake Mendota." Jake, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about what we can learn by doing these samples, these core samples, in effect, of sediment at the bottom of a lake.
Yeah, so it really starts with the challenge of monitoring lakes. Like you said, Lake Mendota is one of the most well-studied lakes in the world. But even there, we can't be sampling it all the time. We sampled it something like 15 times per year since the late 1970s, but that still leaves something like 350 unsampled days. And so, not to mention the days that that weren't sampled before we started routinely monitoring the lake. And so lake sediments can actually help us complement those long-term data sets that we collect at the Center for Limnology. So we can see some of those changes, and like you said, better understand how to manage water quality in the lake. And so we ended up, we ended up coring Lake Mendota back in 2015, and we ended up pulling 4 feet of sediment from the core, which corresponded to something like 200 years of long-term ecological change in the lake. And so we were really excited to dig into what that might mean for managing water quality.
And yeah, talk about how that lake bottom builds up over the years, because from our perspective, well, A, we can't see the bottom, but it seems like it's one thing unchanging. But in fact, as you say, over a couple hundred years, layers are settling on top of each other over time.
Absolutely. And so Lake Mendota is a particularly productive lake. So there's a lot of algae in there. It's living and dying. And as it dies, it settles to the bottom of the lake and decays along with any other materials that aren't used in the lake. And so those layers of dead algae and other materials build up over time. And they leave this archive that we can actually dig into and use it to understand what was going on in the lake, say, 200 years ago.
And I would think, oh, okay, you're going to do this sample and it's going to take this really sophisticated study, and it does. But also, you write, you can look and you can see the difference, kind of a before and after picture, before European settlement and after. How does that play out in these samples you're pulling up?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So our study was largely on looking at the chemical composition of the core, but this was something that we could see plainly the second we pulled the core out of the water. So we have a clear plastic coring tube, and you can see in the really deep, old sediments, they tend to be much lighter, and that they're rich in calcite from the surrounding limestone in the watershed of Lake Mendota. But then as you move up in the core, you see this very abrupt transition into much darker material, much muckier, or at least what we would traditionally think of as muck. And that's really rich in organic matter from that decaying algae. And so what we found is that transition corresponds to the European settlement of Madison and population growth and growth in agriculture that came along with that. And so with more agriculture and with more human activity came more nutrient runoff into the lake, which fertilized algae blooms, which is why we see that dark color from dead and decaying algae with that transition.
And there's a more recent band at the top of your sample that's starting maybe to look a little like the old days again?
Yeah, so that was actually one of the things that I found most exciting about this work is that as you move up into the core, into the more recently laid bands and layers, you start to see the core lighten up again. And we found this actually corresponded to the 1970s and 80s, which is right when Madison really started to buckle down on managing water quality in the lake. As a response to the Clean Water Act. And so a lot of ways, this is a really cool indicator that maybe the lake's starting to respond, which is something that we've been able to show in some of our long-term monitoring data, but seeing it reflected in the sediment is actually pretty powerful.
Before we dig into the nutrients and the algae a bit, I want to step back a little. Now, Lake Mendota, this is a lake in Madison. It's studied a lot. Do we learn lessons from this one lake that people are applying to lakes elsewhere in the state, the country, the world?
Absolutely. So Lake Mendota is known globally. It's one of the iconic research sites that we use in the field of limnology, the study of inland waters. But also it's representative of a lot of the lakes that we see in south central Wisconsin that are sort of subject to this nutrient runoff from agriculture, but also nested in these limestone watersheds. So they share a lot of qualities, and we can use what we learn in Mendota, hopefully to manage more lakes in Wisconsin as well.
Talking to limnology researcher Jake Walsh about a piece he wrote on WisContext about research on Lake Mendota in Madison using core samples to study the history of the lake, how runoff and other kinds of pollution affect the lake. Jake, you introduced me to a new concept, or new to me, I should say, in your piece, whitening, and the interaction between the algae and these this mineral, the calcites, I think it was. Can you give us the Cliff's Notes version of how that works?
Absolutely. So one thing that we saw in the very surface layers of these cores are these thin white bands, and we found that they're made primarily of calcite, and these calcite crystals are actually formed after algae blooms. So algae takes up huge amounts of CO2 from the water when it blooms, which changes the water chemistry, allowing these calcite crystals to form. And so they're indicative of a couple things going on in the lake. And the first thing is that calcite crystals don't actually form if there's too much phosphorus in the water. So phosphorus is a nutrient that fertilizes algae, but it can also suppress the formation of these crystals. So these whiting bands might actually be an indicator that phosphorus levels are down from where they were historically. And the second thing is that calcite crystals themselves can actually be a control on water quality in the lake. Calcite can bind to phosphorus, and then when it sinks to the bottom of the lake, because these crystals are dense, it can actually bury that phosphorus in the bottom of the lake and prevent it from otherwise fertilizing an algae bloom. And so one really key research area that we're excited about at the Center for Limnology is thinking about how is phosphorus buried in the lake, because that could help us improve water quality sort of at the margins as we're trying to tackle this really key challenge of reducing the agricultural runoff into the lake.
Now, check me on this to make sure I have this right, Jake. It sounds like in a way the lake has almost a self-regulating system even after a big algae bloom, but we kind of shut that system down if we let too much phosphorus run in. Do I have that right?
Absolutely, yeah. So we call it a negative feedback, but you're right, it's self-regulating, but it doesn't work if there's too many nutrients. And we think that's why we didn't see whiting bands from European settlement up until the late 70s in our sediment core.
Now, you mentioned farm runoff, agricultural runoff being one source of phosphorus and other nutrients. Have there been other things over the years, decades, I guess, that have contributed to that too?
Yeah, so present day, agricultural runoff contributes something like 70% of the phosphorus load. So that's why it's the primary focus of really trying to manage nutrients in the lake. But historically, we had a lot more sources from sort of urban Madison, either from human sewage or from fertilizer on the land that fertilized these algae blooms before the Clean Water Act. And so what the Clean Water Act really helped us do was divert some of those direct inputs like sewage or even fertilizer on our lawns so that we can reduce that phosphorus. And so what remained after the Clean Water Act is trying to tie up the phosphorus that we apply to our farm fields with manure.
But even a partial fix from the Clean Water Act, coming back to those samples, apparently made a visible difference in the sediment of the lake, right?
It did, yeah.
So what are you watching for next? We've got these regular samples, these core samples. What do you want to know that we don't know yet about how water quality changes over the years?
So one thing that we are excited about and looking forward to is learning about how phosphorus is buried in Lake Mendota and how calcite can play a role in that. We really just sort of can point at that with our sediment core, but we have some work to do in terms of understanding how much phosphorus could be buried in that pathway or what other factors might lead to phosphorus burial in the lake. And so, like I mentioned before, I think it could be a useful area as we keep running into issues with managing nutrient runoff from farms, particularly with climate change bringing more extreme rain events that has made that agricultural runoff issue much more challenging.
Jake, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
That's Jake Walsh, postdoctoral research fellow with the Minnesota Aquatic Invasive Species Research Center at the University of Minnesota. He's done work, the work we talked about just now, with UW-Madison's Center for Limnology. He was with us today to talk about core samples from the bottom of Madison's Lake Mendota, arguably the most studied lake in the world, and what those samples tell us about water quality. You can read more about his story online at wiscontext.org. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue told reporters at the World Dairy Expo in Madison yesterday that family farms may need to get bigger to make it and that small dairy farms may not be viable. We'll get a reaction from the president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Now it's time to stand in front of the news fire hose and our weekly look at the latest stories from Washington. Facebook's CEO and Senator Elizabeth Warren traded words over her pledge to break up big technology companies. New polling shows the Postal Service is the most popular agency in the federal government. And the biggest news this week is a slew of subpoenas from congressional committees as the House begins its formal impeachment inquiry. Meanwhile, President Trump says he's trying to find out the identity of a whistleblower in the intelligence community who first raised concerns over Trump asking the Ukrainian president to investigate the Bidens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or thoughts about anything going on with the impeachment inquiry and the White House response? What are you curious to find out as it all moves forward? Are you worried with what we know so far? And ultimately, do you want to see a vote on impeachment in the House, a trial in the Senate? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent for The Hill. Reed, welcome back.
Hey, man, fire hose is the exact right term.
That's how I feel. Yeah, yeah. So there's been, let's start with subpoenas. We got to start somewhere. Congressional committees saying, hey, we want testimony, some documents related to the Ukraine phone call. What are you watching for when it comes to who is being subpoenaed?
Well, this is really a balance of power struggle here, and it's one that the White House is not likely to win. We've seen Secretary of State Mike Pompeo saying that the State Department employees who have been subpoenaed will not show up to testify before Congress. The Supreme Court has ruled on this in the past, and it doesn't tend to work out well for an administration. What I'm really watching is sort of when the dam breaks. You know, we've got a number of concurrent investigations going on, whether it's the House Judiciary Committee, the House Oversight Committee, of course, the House Intelligence Committee with Congressman Adam Schiff as the chairman over there. And they all have these document requests into the White House or subpoena requests. President Trump has famously said that he's going to resist basically every subpoena that the Democrats throw at him. Well, at some point, a court is going to force him to comply with some of these subpoenas. And once that dam breaks, it's not likely to be plugged up again. Once the first subpoenas begin to be enforced, there's going to be a rush of documents coming out of the White House.
Now, Secretary Pompeo says his people aren't going to testify, but some of them, or at least past State Department officials, at least a couple of them said, yeah, actually we are.
Yeah, and we've seen a number of those now former officials, including Kurt Volker, the former liaison to or the special envoy to the Ukraine, say that he will testify. There are going to be some other officials. I can imagine that Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, is going to be either compelled to turn over some documents or come up and actually testify on Capitol Hill. It seemed this week that every time he showed up on Fox News, he dug his own hole a little deeper. So we'll see what he does in front of, you know, questioners who are actually trying to get an answer out of him rather than the friendly confines of Fox News. But this is a, you know, after what has felt like 2 years of incremental movement, if any movement at all, you know, this last couple of weeks has just felt like everything is moving extremely quickly.
This all has a lot to do with this phone call between President Trump and the Ukrainian president. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo again said this week he was on that phone call. He was listening to that phone call. Here's a listen to the Secretary of State.
As for was I on the phone call, I was on the phone call. The phone call was in the context of now, I guess I've been the Secretary of State for coming on a year and a half. I know precisely what the American policy is with respect to Ukraine. It's been remarkably consistent.
And the key point of that call that people keep coming back to, one of the key points the whistleblower raised, confirmed in the sort of partial transcript released by the White House, is that the president indicated to the president of Ukraine that he wanted him to investigate Biden's. That's still kind of at the heart of this, right, Reid?
It is, but it seems to be rippling outward from there. And right now, Attorney General Bob Barr is in Italy, where he's been meeting with Italian Secret Service. That has something to do with relations to with regard to the Steele dossier, the document that was initially funded by a conservative think tank and then funded by the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee. This smacks of a huge number of foreign countries being asked to help the actual political prospects of the president of the United States. One of the reporters today, that the president today met with the president of Finland, and one of the questions that a reporter lobbed at the president of Finland was, what has the president of the United States asked you to do? And the president of Finland sort of waved that off and made a little joke about it. But, you know, at this point, that's where we are. We're at multiple countries now that have confirmed that they've been asked to do something on behalf of President Trump.
Multiple press conferences today. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff gave one of them. Here's a listen to some of what Chair Schiff had to say.
If you think about what the framers were concerned about at the time of the drafting of the Constitution, they were paramountly concerned about foreign interference in American affairs. They wanted to ensure that the President of the United States was defending the interests and national security of the United States and not corruptly, secretly advancing some private agenda with a foreign power. It's hard to imagine a set of circumstances that would have alarmed the founders more than what's on that call.
With an impeachment inquiry, Reid, there's been a question of, okay, how wide will the scope be for Democrats? Is that what we just heard there, an indication that they're trying to keep the eye on the ball in this case being the president trying to work with foreign governments related to elections?
That is my understanding for the moment. And Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, has said that she wants the impeachment inquiry to be narrowly focused. However, there are a number of different strands and sort of layers here. And I'll add that, you know, during the Nixon impeachment, the obstruction of justice charge, the third article of impeachment, was introduced substantially later than the first two that the House Judiciary Committee ended up voting on. So, this can sort of metastasize over time. And if the president faces one charge now, but ends up covering up or obstructing the investigation, that can lead to additional charges. You know, what's the old line? It's not the crime, it's the cover up. And if the president is seen as covering up and obstructing a legal, you know, legitimate congressional investigation, that is not going to go well for the White House. And it could be the catalyst for expanding this well beyond, you know, one phone call with Ukraine.
Talking to Reid Wilson from The Hill. It's our weekly look at the latest news in national politics, talking about all the stuff related to impeachment and everything spinning out from that. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Butler. Joe, hi.
Hello there. Well, my comment was twofold. Number one, Bob Woodward this morning was commenting that he felt that while this singular article of impeachment focusing on this is clear and unambiguous, it may not be enough to motivate the Republicans in the Senate to vote favorably. However, he also, in a different interview, I believe it was he and Charlie Sykes back-to-back in a couple of weeks ago, mentioned that the Senate Rules Committee, if we do get an impeachment out of the House and it goes to the Senate, that the Senate Rules Committee, which is not chaired by Mitch McConnell, could pass a rule for the anonymous balloting of the trial, presided over by the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, according to the Constitution, John Roberts, who is decidedly not in the White House pocket.
Joe, thanks for the call. Read, that dovetails with something you wrote about. You dug into some of the procedure that would happen if we go through this, if the House votes to impeach the president, it goes to the Senate. Can you first talk a little bit about what Joe had to say?
Right. So this is, and Joe gets to the point that this is a sort of a, we're in a little bit of uncharted waters here, and the Senate has not always had, I mean, the Constitution does not lay out details of the process for impeachment. They lay out the broad overview. So first of all, just to remind everybody of their high school civics, the House impeaches the president, and then the Senate holds a trial that determines whether or not to actually convict him. So the impeachment itself is not the removal from office. So once the House impeaches, the Senate rules say that the Senate must convene a trial that literally the next day. The House impeachment managers will walk over. They'll do some sort of rearranging of the furniture, give them a table up front. And I mean, it's a very complex thing. But the fact, I mean, I spent last week on the phone with, you know, some of the Senate rules experts, and even they didn't exactly know whether or not Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, had to hold a trial. Now, he said this week that he would have no choice but to bring up a trial. But let me throw in a little wrinkle here. There is a provision in the Senate rules that allows any senator to bring up a motion to dismiss the charges. That would take only a simple majority vote. During the Clinton impeachment hearings, Senator Robert Byrd, you know, the master of the Senate, brought up a motion to dismiss. That failed along a party line vote. Remember, Republicans were in charge of the Senate back then. This time around, Republicans are in charge of the Senate. It would only take a simple majority. So that would basically give Democrats, you know, they'd have to peel off three or four Republicans to keep an actual trial going.
Thanks for that call, Joe. Joe mentioned that idea that the Rules Committee could change the rules to make it an anonymous vote by senators. A former Republican senator said something like, yeah, if there was an anonymous vote, 25 or something like that, Republicans would vote against the president. Is that something that could actually happen?
You know, that I don't know.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that before.
I did not come across that in reading the rules, or Congressional Research Service has done a long look at impeachments in the past. But, you know, I mean, this does reflect the fact that, you know, we've only done this twice. We've only impeached a president twice in our nation's history, or rather had the trial twice in our nation's history. Nixon resigned before he was actually impeached. So Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton are our only two examples. And the Senate has, you know, last revised their impeachment rules only as recently as 1986. So, you know, there are some rules that are meant to be rewritten, and we may be rewriting it now.
Talking about the week's top political news with Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and thoughts about the latest in the impeachment efforts. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, looking at the week's political news. Back to your calls now on things related to impeachment. Marcus is with us now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Good afternoon, Rob. So I feel that we're at a point in our country's history that we need to set aside the partisan political gamesmanship and really have some of our leaders in government step up and really take a statesman-type role, because if they don't, we may regret this point in our history and look back and realize that it might have been something that did damage to the fragile representative democracy and the light that is in the world.
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. Reed, Marcus taking a long view. Do you see that argument coming from people, say, in Congress, for example?
We see it a little bit. There are glimpses now. I mean, this is a really fraught moment where the entire, you know, all the spotlight is basically on Senate Republicans right now and what they're going to do. And virtually any Senate Republican who votes to acquit President Trump is going to be accused of putting party over country and things like that, regardless of what the evidence is. If the evidence is very slim and sort of a flimsy case, they'll be assailed just as much as if it's an ironclad sort of gift that the House Democrats give to them. We've heard a few senators. You know, I mentioned that motion to dismiss and whether or not there would be enough senators who would be peeled off in order to deny a motion to dismiss right after the trial begins. And we've heard comments from at least one senator, Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, who has voiced some serious concerns about this this call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine. And there are, a few other senators. You mentioned Jeff Flake, the former senator, who said in an NPR interview earlier this week that there may be as many as 35 senators who could peel off and vote against President Trump if it were a secret ballot. There's a big difference between a secret ballot and a public ballot. President Trump has a massive command on the Republican Party right now. We'll see how many senators are willing to buck that if the evidence is sufficient. But let's let the evidence come in first. Let's not race to say that any vote either way is a vote for party over country.
Bring on another caller. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi. My question is this. If the Democrats called for impeachment right after the president was elected and not even inaugurated, how can you build support amongst the people, which you will need, even amongst Democrats, in order to actually impeach the president when you're just fulfilling a prophecy that you had made after the election?
Tom, thanks for the call. And that's a question that it seems, Reed, to have held Speaker Nancy Pelosi up, the concern that public opinion was not there when it came to impeachment until a week ago, basically.
Yeah, and now we've already started to see the needle moving. It's amazing. If the president is impeached, and if he is either removed or he loses re-election next year, we're going to look back at this last week with the reports of the phone call with the president of Ukraine as the serious tipping point and one that changed the course of this part of American history. I have not seen, Robert Mueller's report came out. It looked pretty, once you actually read through it, it was a pretty remarkable document, but it was not enough to shift public opinion. This has actually shifted public opinion. And, Democrats have been in favor of impeachment. Democratic voters have been in favor of impeachment. We're starting to see movement among independents. And most troubling to President Trump, we're even starting to see a little bit of movement among Republicans who say, yeah, it's time to open an inquiry, even if they're not on board with the full impeachment yet.
Tom, thanks for the call. One more thread on this before we visit the post office. President Trump, you mentioned he had a press conference today. He addressed comments from Representative Adam Schiff at a congressional hearing. Here's a listen to the president.
He should resign from office in disgrace. And frankly, they should look at him for treason because he is making up the words of the president of the United States. Not only words, but the meaning, and it's a disgrace. It should not be allowed to happen.
He's referring to Representative Schiff, paraphrasing the president's comments in kind of a mocking way. And he said the president, said this is the intent, but not the words. Schiff had said that originally. People are looking at the president throwing around words like treason, tweeting comments from other people about a civil war. Should the president leave office? The president's tone over the last week, Reid.
It's remarkable. This press conference we saw today was a press conference held by a very angry man and somebody who is increasingly feeling backed into a corner. I think the White House has been taken aback by just how fierce the anger and sort of blowback to this phone call has been. It doesn't seem like they really have a plan. I don't know. I couldn't tell you what the White House's strategy to deal with this is, aside from continuing to attack Joe Biden and continuing to attack Adam Schiff. Adam Schiff, a person who approximately 2% of Americans know who he actually is. That number is going to grow in the next few months if he becomes sort of the centerpiece of this impeachment inquiry. But aside from attacking the messenger and questioning the credibility of the whistleblower whose complaint has has been verified by documents that the White House has issued themselves. You know, it doesn't feel like a lot of a strategy. And I think it points to the fact that this is a White House that has not made the preparations that, say, Bill Clinton's White House did in advance of his impeachment, or even Richard Nixon's White House did. So this is a troubling moment, and one in which President Trump very clearly feels backed into a corner.
Talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national news. Switch gears here, Reed, to something you talked about, survey data out from Pew Research Center about the federal agencies viewed most favorably by the public. Who wins?
Yeah, I love this. You know, Americans right now believe that the federal government does not do the right thing the vast majority of the time. A very small percentage of Americans think that the federal government gets it right. But when you talk about individual agencies within the federal government, we really like a lot of them. 90% of Americans have a favorable opinion of the U.S. Postal Service, 86% of the National Park Service, you know, and NASA's at 81%, CDC's at 80%. Heck, even the FBI, 70% of Americans have a favorable opinion. So there's a really funny difference there. We don't think that the federal government is doing the right thing, but these individual agencies, yeah, they're getting it right most of the time.
It's kind of like the surveys where, yeah, nobody likes Congress, but everybody likes their own congressional representative, or a lot of people like their own representative.
And I guess everybody likes getting mail every day.
So the IRS, right, the tax people, they even had net favorable. Did I read that right?
That's right. 55% of Americans see the IRS favorably. Only 40% see them unfavorably. As a matter of fact, of the 16 agencies that Pew Research Center asked about, only one agency had a net unfavorable rating, and that was ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which, of course, has been at the heart of President Trump's immigration policies, the most controversial immigration policies of the last couple of years. So even groups like, you know, the Veterans Affairs Administration, which is a department which has had such a terrible last decade and a half, they're even seen favorably by more people than see them unfavorably. The Department of Justice, which is, again, at the centerpiece of a lot of President Trump's most controversial issues, has a net favorable rating. So we tend to like our agencies. It's funny how that happens.
And ICE, you saw a big partisan split on that.
Right. Even though it's seen net unfavorably, 70% of Republicans say they see ICE favorably, whereas just 19% of Democrats do. And that was the widest gap. The funny thing about this poll is that the vast majority of federal agencies, Democrats and Republicans, pretty much see eye to eye. You know, there's a point or two difference between the number of Dems and the number of Republicans who see the Postal Service favorably, or the CIA or something like that. But as we get down to ICE, that's the one government agency that really divides the partisans. Almost three quarters of Republicans and just one fifth of Democrats see ICE favorably.
So for the presidential candidates out there, running on a strong U.S. Postal Service platform could be the way to go. I don't know what that would be.
For heaven's sake, don't raise the price of stamps anymore.
Reed, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us again today.
Thanks, Rob. Talk to you soon.
That's Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. He joined us for a look at the week in Washington. By the way, tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to David Greenberg, professor of history and journalism and media studies at Rutgers. He wrote a piece over at Politico cautioning people against comparing this current impeachment case about President Trump to previous cases, including Presidents Andrew Johnson, Richard Nixon, and Bill Clinton. He will join us to compare and contrast to tell us why some of the past lessons may not apply to today's. And in the meantime, you can still let us know what you think about the impeachment inquiry, or maybe a question for our guest historian tomorrow. You can let us know your thoughts and questions. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email. Send it. Our producer will look at it right away. You can always email us at ideas@WPR.org. There was a chaotic moment in the nation's capital yesterday, and the White House press corps was scrambling to stay on top of a fluid situation. No, it wasn't the impeachment story. It was a mouse. A mouse fell, apparently, from the ceiling of the White House press booth. The first reporter on top of the story, or technically under the story, was NBC's Peter Alexander. The mouse fell on his lap before running for cover. After a brief chase, the mouse escaped and is believed to still be at large. I did some digging around online. It turns out this isn't the first time rodents have been a story in the White House. And no, that's not political commentary. Most recently, I see that rats were spotted on the White House lawn back in December of last year. But it goes further back than that. For example, in 1935, Eleanor Roosevelt, First Lady, commented in a radio address about the constant battle to keep the White House free of rats and mice. That's from the New York Times archives. And here's something. Carolyn Harrison, First Lady to President Benjamin Harrison, this is in the late 1800s, she came up with a solution to all the rodents in the White House. She released ferrets to run through the crawl spaces and hunt for rats and mice. I don't know if that was an obligation of my last name, but if my nation calls me, I will crawl through the White House crawl space to hunt for rodents myself. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.